showing Jamie's face looking anxiously down at me. "All right," I said, taking a deep breath. "Carry on." The prisoner was below in what the crew called the orlop, a lower deck space full of miscellaneous cargo. It was a small timbered area walled off at the bow of the ship that sometimes housed drunk or unruly seamen, and here he had been secured. It was dark and airless down in the bowels of the ship, and I felt myself becoming dizzy again as I made my way slowly along the companionway behind Jamie and the glow of his lantern. When he unlocked the door, at first I saw nothing at all in the makeshift brig. Then, as Jamie stooped to enter with his lantern, the shine of the man's eyes betrayed his presence. Black as the ace of spades was the first thought that popped into my slightly addled mind, as the edges of face and form took shape against the darkness of the timbers. No wonder Jamie had thought him a runaway slave. The man looked African, not island-born. Besides the deep red-black of his skin, his demeanour wasn't that of a man raised as a slave. He was sitting on a cask, hands bound behind his back and feet tied together, but I saw his head rise and his shoulders straighten as Jamie ducked under the lintel of the tiny space. He was very thin, but very muscular, clad in nothing but a ragged pair of trousers. The lines of his body were clear. He was tensed for attack or defence, but not submission. Jamie saw it too, and motioned me to stay well back against the wall. He placed the lantern on a cask and squatted down before the captive at eye level. "Amiki," he said, spreading out his empty hands, palm up. "Amiki, bini, bini. Friend is good." It was Taki Taki, the all-purpose pidgin polyglot that the traders from Barbados to Trinidad spoke in the ports. The man stared impassively at Jamie for a moment, eyes still as tide pools. Then one eyebrow flicked up, and he extended his bound feet before him. "Bene, bene, amici," he said, with an ironic intonation that couldn't be missed, whatever the language. "Is good, friend." Jamie snorted briefly, amused, and rubbed a finger under his nose. "It's a point," he said in English. "Does he speak English or French?" I moved a little closer. The captive's eyes rested on me for a moment, then passed away, indifferent.
"If he does, he'll no admit it. Picard and Fergus tried talking to him last night. He wouldn't say a word, just stares at them. What he just said is the first he's spoken since he came aboard." "Habla español," he said suddenly to the prisoner. There was no response.
The man didn't even look at Jamie, just went on staring impassively at the square of open doorway behind me.
Sprechen Sie Deutsch?" I said tentatively.
He didn't answer, which was just as well, as the question had exhausted my own supply of German.
"Nicht Holländer either, I don't suppose."
Jamie shot me a sardonic look.
"I cannot tell much about him, Sassenach, but I'm fairly sure he's no a Dutchman."
"Well, they have slaves on Eleuthera, don't they? That's a Dutch island," I said irritably. "Or St. Croix? That's Danish, isn't it?" Slowly as my mind was working this morning, it hadn't escaped me that the captive was our only clue to the pirate's whereabouts, and the only frail link to Ian.
"Do you know enough, Taki Taki, to ask him about Ian?"
Jamie shook his head, eyes intent on the prisoner.
"No. Besides what I said to him already, I ken how to say not good. How much? Give it to me. And drop that, you bastard. None of which seems a great deal to the point at present."
Stymied for the moment, we stared at the prisoner, who stared impassively back.
"To hell with it,"
Jamie said suddenly. He drew the dirk from his belt, went behind the cask, and sawed through the thongs around the prisoner's wrists. He cut the ankle bindings as well, then sat back on his heels, the knife laid across his thigh.
"Friend," he said firmly in Taki Taki, "is good."
The prisoner didn't say anything, But after a moment he nodded slightly, his expression warily quizzical.
"There's a chamber pot in the corner," Jamie said in English, rising and sheathing his dirk. "Use it, and then my wife will tend your wounds."
A very faint flicker of amusement crossed the man's face. He nodded once more, this time in acceptance of defeat. He rose slowly from the cask and turned, stiff hands fumbling at his trousers. I looked askance at Jamie.
"It's one of the worst things about being bound that way," he explained matter-of-factly. "You cannot take a piss by yourself."
"I see," I said,
not wanting to think about how he knew that. "That, and the pain in your shoulders," he said. "Be careful touching him, Sassenach."
The note of warning in his voice was clear, and I nodded. It wasn't the man's shoulders he was concerned about. I still felt light-headed, and the stuffiness of the surroundings had made my headache throb again, but I was less battered than the prisoner, who had indeed been bashed about at some stage of the proceedings. Bashed though he was, his injuries seemed largely superficial. A swollen knot rose on the man's forehead, and a deep scrape had left a crusted reddish patch on one shoulder. He was undoubtedly bruised in a number of places, but given the remarkably deep shade of his skin and the darkness of the surroundings, I couldn't tell where. There were deep bands of rawness on ankles and wrists where he had pulled against the thongs. I hadn't made any of the hawthorn lotion, but I had brought the jar of gentian salve. I eased myself down on the deck next to him, but he took no more notice of me than of the deck beneath his feet, even when I began to spread the cool blue cream on his wounds. What was more interesting than the fresh injuries, though, were the healed ones. At close range I could see the faint white lines of three parallel slashes running across the slope of each cheekbone, and a series of three short vertical lines on the high, narrow forehead just between his brows. Tribal scars. African-born for sure, then. Such scars were made during manhood rituals, or so Murphy had told me. His flesh was warm and smooth under my fingers, slicked with sweat. I felt warm too, sweaty and unwell. The deck rose gently beneath me, and I put my hand on his back to keep my balance. The thin, tough lines of healed whip strokes webbed his shoulders like the furrows of tiny worms beneath his skin. The feel of them was unexpected, so much like the feel of the marks on Jamie's own back. I swallowed, feeling queasy, but went on with my doctoring. The man ignored me completely, even when I touched spots I knew must be painful. His eyes were fixed on Jamie, who was watching the prisoner with equal intentness. The problem was plain. The man was almost certainly a runaway slave. He hadn't wanted to speak to us for fear that his speech would give away his owner's island, and that we would then find out his original owner and return him to captivity. Now we knew that he spoke, or at least understood English, it was bound to increase his wariness. Even if we assured him that it wasn't our intention either to return him to an owner or to enslave him ourselves, he was unlikely to trust us. I couldn't say that I blamed him under the circumstances. On the other hand, this man was our best and possibly the only chance of finding out what had happened to Ian Murray aboard the Bruja. When at length I had bandaged the man's wrists and ankles, Jamie gave me a hand to rise, then spoke to the prisoner.
"You'll be hungry, I expect," he said. "Come along to the cabin and we'll eat."
Not waiting for a response, he took my good arm and turned to the door. There was silence behind us as we moved into the corridor, but when I looked back, the slave was there, following a few feet behind. Jamie led us to my cabin, disregarding the curious glances of the sailors we passed, only stopping by Fergus long enough to order food to be sent from the galley.
"Back to bed with you, Sassenach,"
he said firmly when we reached the cabin. I didn't argue. My arm hurt, my head hurt, and I could feel little waves of heat flickering behind my eyes. It looked as though I would have to break down and use a little of the precious penicillin on myself after all. There was still a chance that my body could throw off the infection, but I couldn't afford to wait too long.
This ends Disc 29. Voyager, Disc 30.
Jamie had poured out a glass of whiskey for me, and another for our guest. Still wary, the man accepted it, and took a sip, eyes widening in surprise. I suppose Scotch whiskey must be a novelty to him. Jamie took a glass for himself and sat down, motioning the slave to the other seat across the small table.
"My name is Fraser," he said. "I am captain here. And my wife," he added, with a nod toward my berth.
The prisoner hesitated, but then set down his glass with an air of decision.
"They be calling me Ishmael," he said,
in a voice like honey poured over coal.
"I ain't no pirate. I be a cook."
"Murphy's going to like that," I remarked. But Jamie ignored me. There was a faint line between the ruddy brows as he felt his way into the conversation.
"A ship's cook?"
he asked, taking care to make his voice sound casual. Only the tap of his two stiff fingers against his thigh betrayed him, and that only to me.
"No, mon. I don't got nothing to do with that ship."
Ishmael was vehement.
"They've taken me off the shore. Say they kill me. I don't go long by them. Be easy. I ain't no pirate," he repeated.
And it dawned on me belatedly that of course he wouldn't wish to be taken for a pirate, whether he was one or not. Piracy was punishable by hanging, and he could have no way of knowing that we were as eager as he to stay clear of the Royal Navy.
"Aye, I see."
Jamie hit the right balance between soothing and sceptical. He leaned back slightly in the big wheel-back chair.
"And how did the Bruja come to take you prisoner, then?
Not where," he added quickly, as a look of alarm flitted across the prisoner's face.
"You needna tell me where you came from. That's of no concern to me. Only I should care to know how you came to fall into their hands, and how long you've been with them, since, as you say, you were not one of them."
The hint was broad enough to spread batter on. We didn't mean to return him to his owner. However, if he didn't oblige with information, we might just turn him over to the Crown as a pirate. The prisoner's eyes darkened. No fool, he had grasped the point at once. His head twitched briefly sideways, and his eyes narrowed.
"I be catching fish by the river," he said. "Big ship. He comes sailing up the river slow. Little boats be pulling him. Men in the little boat, they see me, holler out. I drop the fish, be running, but they close by. They men jump out, catch me by the cane field, figure they take me to sell. That's all, mon."
He shrugged, signalling the conclusion of his story.
"Aye, I see."
Jamie's eyes were intent on the prisoner. He hesitated, wanting to ask where the river was, but not quite daring to, for fear the man would clam up again.
"While you were on the ship, did you see any boys among the crew? Or as prisoners, too? Boys, young men?"
The man's eyes widened slightly. He hadn't been expecting that. He paused warily, but then nodded with a faintly derisive glint in his eye.
"Yes, mon, they have boys. Why, you be wanting one?"
His glance flicked to me and then back to Jamie, one eyebrow raised. Jamie's head jerked, and a slight flush rose on his cheekbones at the implication.
"I do," he said levelly. "I'm looking for a young kinsman who was taken by pirates. I should feel myself greatly obliged to anyone who might assist me in finding him."
He lifted one eyebrow significantly. The prisoner grunted slightly, his nostrils flaring.
"That's so. What you be doing for me, I be helping you find this boy." I should set you ashore at any port of your choosing with a fair sum in gold, Jamie replied. But of course I should require proof that you did have knowledge of my nephew's whereabouts, aye? Ah. The prisoner was still wary, but beginning to relax. You tell me, mon, what this boy be like?
Jamie hesitated for a moment, studying the prisoner, but then shook his head.
No, he said thoughtfully, I don't think that will work. You described to me such lads as you saw on the pirate vessel.
The prisoner eyed Jamie for a moment, then broke out in a low, rich laugh.
You no particular fool, mon, he said. You know that.
I know that, Jamie said dryly, so long as you know it as well. Tell me, then.
Ishmael snorted briefly, but complied, pausing only to refresh himself from the tray of food Fergus had brought. Fergus himself lounged against the door, watching the prisoner through half-lidded eyes.
They be 12 boys, talking strange like you.
Jamie's eyebrows shot up, and he exchanged a glance of astonishment with me. 12?
Like me, he said. White boys? English? Or Scots, do you mean?
Ishmael shook his head in incomprehension. Scot was not in his vocabulary.
Talking like dogs fighting, he explained. Grrr, woof, he growled, shaking his head in illustration like a dog worrying a rat.
And I saw Fergus's shoulders shake in suppressed hilarity.
Scots, for sure, I said, trying not to laugh.
Jamie shot me a brief, dirty look, then returned his attention to Ishmael.
Very well, then, he said, exaggerating his natural soft burr. 12 Scottish lads. What did they look like?
Ishmael squinted dubiously, chewing a piece of mango from the tray. He wiped the juice from the corner of his mouth and shook his head.
I only see them once, mon. Tell you all I see, though.
He closed his eyes and frowned, the vertical lines on his forehead drawing close together.
4 boys be yellow-haired, 6 brown, 2 with black hair. 2 shorter than me, 1 maybe the size that griffon there.
He nodded toward Fergus, who stiffened in outrage at the insult.
1 big, not so big as you.
Aye, and how will they have been dressed?
Slowly, carefully, Jamie drew him through the descriptions, asking for details, demanding comparisons. How tall? How fat? What colour eyes? Carefully concealing the direction of his interest as he drew the man further into conversation. My head had stopped spinning, but the fatigue was still there, weighting my senses. I let my eyes close, obscurely soothed by the deep murmuring voices. Jamie did sound rather like a big, fierce dog, I thought, with his soft, growling burr and the abrupt clip sound of his consonants.
Woof,
I murmured under my breath, and my belly muscles quivered slightly under my folded hands. Ishmael's voice was just as deep, but smooth and low, rich as hot chocolate made with cream. I began to drift, lulled by the sound of it.
He sounded like Joe Abernathy, I thought drowsily, dictating an autopsy report. Unvarnished and unappetizing physical details related in a voice like a deep golden lullaby.
I could see Joe's hands in memory, dark on the pale skin of a victim, moving swiftly as he made his verbal notes to the tape recorder.
Deceased is a tall man. Approximately 6 feet in height and slender in build.
A tall man. Slender.
That one, he being tall, being thin.
I came awake suddenly, heart pounding, hearing the echo of Joe's voice coming from the table a few feet away. No, I said, quite suddenly, and all 3 men stopped and looked at me in surprise. I pushed back the weight of my damp hair and waved weakly at them. Don't mind me. I was dreaming, I think. They returned to their conversation, and I lay still, eyes half closed, but no longer sleepy. There was no physical resemblance. Joe was stocky and bear-like, this Ishmael slender and lean, though the swell of muscle over the curve of his shoulder suggested considerable strength. Joe's face was broad and amiable, this man's narrow and wary-eyed, with a high forehead that made his tribal scars the more striking. Joe's skin was the colour of fresh coffee. Ishmael's the deep red-black of a burning ember, which Stern had told me was characteristic of slaves from the Guinea coast. Not so highly prized as the blue-black Senegalese, but more valuable than the yellow-brown Yaga and Congolese. But if I closed my eyes entirely, I could hear Joe's voice speaking, even allowing for the faint Caribbean lilt of slave English. I cracked my eyelids and looked carefully, searching for any signs of resemblance. There were none. But I did see what I had seen before, and not noticed, among the other scars and marks on the man's battered torso. What I had thought merely a scrape was, in fact, a deep abrasion that overlay a wide, flat scar, cut in the form of a rough square just below the point of the shoulder. The mark was raw and pink, newly healed. I should have seen it at once, if not for the darkness of the orlop and the scrape that obscured it. I lay quite still, trying to remember.
"No slave name," Joe had said derisively, referring to his son's self-christening.
Clearly, Ishmael had cut away an owner's brand to prevent identification should he be recaptured. But whose? And surely the name Ishmael was no more than coincidence. Maybe not so far-fetched a one, though. Ishmael almost certainly wasn't the man's real name.
"They be calling me Ishmael," he had said.
That too was a slave name given him by one owner or another. And if young Lenny had been climbing his family tree, as it seemed, what more likely than that he should have chosen one of his ancestors' given names in symbol? If. But if he was... I lay looking up at the claustrophobic ceiling of the berth, supposition spinning through my head. Whether this man had any link with Joe or not, the possibility had reminded me of something. Jamie was catechizing the man about the personnel and structure of the Bruja, for so the ship that had attacked us had been, but I was paying no attention. I sat up cautiously so as not to make the dizziness worse and signalled to Fergus. "I need air," I said. "Help me up on deck, will you?" Jamie glanced at me with a hint of worry, but I smiled reassuringly at him and took Fergus's arm. "Where are the papers for that slave we bought on Barbados?" I demanded, as soon as we were out of earshot of the cabin. "And where's the slave, for that matter?" Fergus looked at me curiously, but obligingly rummaged in his coat.
"I have the papers here, milady," he said, handing them to me. "As for the slave, I believe he is in the crew's quarters." "Why?" he added, unable to restrain his curiosity.
I ignored the question, fumbling through the grubby, repellent bits of paper. "There it is," I said, finding the bit I remembered Jamie reading to me. "Abernathy." It was Abernathy, branded on the left shoulder with a fleur-de-lis. Did you notice that mark, Fergus? He shook his head, looking mildly bewildered.
"No, milady."
"Then come with me," I said, turning towards the crew quarters. "I want to see how big it is." The mark was about 3 inches long and 3 wide. A flower, surmounting the initial A, burned into the skin a few inches below the point of the shoulder. It was the right size and in the right place to match the scar on the man Ishmael. It wasn't, however, a fleur-de-lis. That had been the mistake of a careless transcriber. It was a 16-petaled rose, the Jacobite emblem of Charles Stuart. I blinked at it in amazement. What patriotic exile had chosen this bizarre method of maintaining allegiance to the vanquished Stuarts?
"Milady, I think you should return to your bed," Fergus said.
He was frowning at me as I stooped over Temeraire, who bore this inspection as stolidly as everything else.
You are the colour of goose turds, and Milord will not like it at all if I allow you to fall down on the deck.
I won't fall down, I assured him, and I don't care what colour I am. I think we've just had a stroke of luck. Listen, Fergus, I want you to do something for me.
Anything, milady,
he said, grabbing me by the elbow as a shift in the wind sent me staggering across the suddenly tilting deck.
But not, he added firmly, until you are safely back in your bed.
I allowed him to lead me back to the cabin, for I really didn't feel at all well, but not before giving him my instructions. As we entered the cabin, Jamie stood up from the table to greet us.
There you are, Sassenach. Are you all right? He asked, frowning down at me. You've gone a nasty colour, like a spoilt custard.
I'm perfectly fine, I said, through my teeth, easing myself down on the bunk to avoid jarring my arm.
Have you and Mr. Ishmael finished your conversation?
Jamie glanced at the prisoner, and I saw the flat black gaze that locked with his. The atmosphere between them wasn't hostile, but it was charged in some way. Jamie nodded in dismissal.
We've finished, for the moment, he said.
He turned to Fergus.
See our guest below, will you, Fergus, and see to it that he's fed and clothed.
He remained standing until Ishmael had left under Fergus's wing. Then he sat down beside my berth and squinted into the darkness at me.
You look awful, he said. Had I best fetch your kit and be feeding you a wee tonic or some such?
No, I said. Jamie, listen. I think I know where our friend Ishmael came from. He lifted one brow.
You do?
I explained about the scar on Ishmael and the almost matching brand on the slave Temeraire, without mentioning what had given me the idea in the first place. 5 will get you 10 that they came from the same place, from this Mrs. Abernathy's on Jamaica, I said.
5, well, och, he said,
waving away my confusing reference in the interests of continuing the discussion.
Well, you could be right, Sassenach, and I hope so. The wily black bastard wouldn't see where he was from. Not that I can blame him, he added fairly. God, if I'd got away from such a life, there's no power on earth would take me back.
He spoke with a surprising vehemence. No, I wouldn't blame him either, I said. But what did he tell you about the boys? Has he seen young Ian? The frowning lines of his face relaxed.
Aye, I'm almost sure he has.
One fist curled on his knee in anticipation.
2 of the lads he described could be Ian. And knowing it was the Brúcha, I canna think otherwise. And if you're right about where he's come from, Sassenach, we might have him. We may find him at last.
Ishmael, while refusing to give any clue as to where the Brúcha had picked him up, had gone so far as to say that the 12 boys, all prisoners, had been taken off the ship together soon after his own capture.
12 lads,
Jamie repeated, his momentary look of excitement fading back into a frown.
What in the name of God would someone be wanting to kidnap 12 lads from Scotland?
Perhaps he's a collector, I said, feeling more light-headed by the moment. Coins and gems and Scottish boys.
I think whoever's got Ian has the treasure as well.
He glanced curiously at me. I don't know, I said, feeling suddenly very tired. I yawned rackingly.
We may know for sure about Ishmael, though. I told Fergus to see that Temeraire gets a look at him. If they're from the same place...
I yawned again, my body seeking the oxygen that loss of blood had deprived me of.
That's very sensible of you, Sassenach,
Jamie said, sounding faintly surprised that I was capable of sense. For that matter, I was a little surprised myself. My thoughts were becoming more fragmented by the moment, and it was an effort to keep talking logically. Jamie saw it. He patted my hand and stood up.
You dinna trouble yourself about it now, Sassenach. Rest, and I'll send Massali down with some tea.
Whiskey, I said,
and he laughed.
All right, then. Whiskey,
he agreed. He smoothed my hair back and, leaning into the berth, kissed my hot forehead.
Better?
He asked, smiling.
Lots.
I smiled back and closed my eyes. Chapter 56 Turtle Soup. When I woke again in the late afternoon, I ached all over. I had thrown off the covers in my sleep and lay sprawled in my shift, my skin hot and dry in the soft air. My arm ached abominably, and I could feel each of Mr. Willoughby's 43 elegant stitches like red-hot safety pins stuck through my flesh. No help for it. I was going to have to use the penicillin. I might be proof against smallpox, typhoid, and the common cold in its 18th-century incarnation, but I wasn't immortal, and God only knew what insanitary substances the Portuguese had been employing his cutlass on before applying it to me. The short trip across the room to the cupboard where my clothes hung left me sweating and shivering, and I had to sit down quite suddenly, the skirt clutched to my bosom in order to avoid falling.
Sassenach, are you all right?
Jamie poked his head through the low doorway, looking worried.
No, I said. Come here a minute, will you? I need you to do something.
Wine? A biscuit? Murphy's made a wee broth for you, special.
He was beside me in a moment, the back of his hand cool against my flushed cheek.
God, you're burning.
Yes, I know, I said. Don't worry, though. I have medicine for it.
I fumbled one-handed in the pocket of the skirt and pulled out the case containing the syringes and ampules. My right arm was sore enough that any movement made me clench my teeth.
Your turn, I said, wryly, shoving the case across the table toward Jamie. Here's your chance for revenge, if you want it.
He looked blankly at the case, then at me.
What? He said. You want me to stab you with one of these spikes?
I wish you wouldn't put it quite that way, but yes, I said.
In the bum?
His lips twitched.
Yes, damn you!
He looked at me for a moment, one corner of his mouth curling slightly upward. Then he bowed his head over the case, red hair glowing in the shaft of sun from the window.
Tell me what to do then, he said.
I directed him carefully, guiding him through the preparation and filling of the syringe, and then took it myself, checking for air bubbles, clumsily, left-handed. By the time I'd given it back to him and arranged myself on the berth, he had ceased to find anything faintly funny about the situation.
Are you sure you want me to do it? He said doubtfully. I'm no very good with my hands.
That made me laugh, in spite of my throbbing arm. I had seen him do everything with those hands, from delivering foals and building walls to skinning deer and setting type, all with the same light and dexterous touch.
Well, he said, when I said as much, but it's no quite the same, is it? The closest thing I've done to this is to dirk a man in the weem, and it feels a bit strange to think of doing such a thing to you, Sassenach.
I glanced back over my shoulder to find him gnawing dubiously on his lower lip, the brandy-soaked pad in one hand, the syringe held gingerly in the other.
Look, I said, I did it to you. You know what it feels like. It wasn't that bad, was it?
He was beginning to make me rather nervous. Pressing his lips together, he knelt down by the bed and gently wiped a spot on my backside with the cool, wet pad.
Is this all right?
That's fine. Press the point in at a bit of an angle, not straight in. You see how the point of the needle's cut at an angle? Push it in about a quarter inch. Don't be afraid to jab a bit. Skin's tougher than you think to get through. Then push down the plunger very slowly. You don't want to do it too fast.
I closed my eyes and waited. After a moment, I opened them and looked back. He was pale, and a faint sheen of sweat glimmered over his cheekbones.
Never mind.
I heaved myself upright, bracing against the wave of dizziness.
Here, give me that.
I snatched the pad from his hand and swiped a patch across the top of my thigh. My hand trembled slightly from the fever.
But...
Shut up! I took the syringe and aimed it as well as I could, left-handed, then plunged it into the muscle. It hurt. It hurt more when I pressed down on the plunger and my thumb slipped off. Then Jamie's hands were there, one steadying my leg, the other on the needle, slowly pressing down until the last of the white liquid had vanished from the tube. I took one quick, deep breath when he pulled it out. "Thanks," I said, after a moment.
"I'm sorry," he said softly, a minute later.
His hand came behind my back, easing me down.
"It's all right."
My eyes were closed, and there were little coloured patterns on the inside of my eyelids. They reminded me of the lining of a doll's suitcase I had had as a child. Tiny pink and silver stars on a dark background.
I'd forgotten. It's hard to do it the first few times. I suppose sticking a dirk in someone is easier, I added. You aren't worried about hurting them, after all.
He didn't say anything, but exhaled rather strongly through his nose. I could hear him moving about the room, putting the case of syringes away and hanging up my skirt. The sight of the injection felt like a knot under my skin.
"I'm sorry," I said. "I didn't mean it that way."
"Well, you should," he said evenly. "It is easier to kill someone to save your own life than it is to hurt someone to save theirs. You're a deal braver than I am, and I didn't mind your saying so."
I opened my eyes and looked at him.
"The hell you don't?"
He stared down at me, blue eyes narrowed. The corner of his mouth turned up.
"The hell I don't," he agreed.
I laughed, but it hurt my arm.
"I'm not and you aren't, and I didn't mean it that way anyway," I said, and closed my eyes again.
"Mm-hmm."
I could hear the thump of feet on the deck above, and Mr. Warren's voice raised in organized impatience. We had passed Great Abaco and Eleuthera in the night, and were now headed south toward Jamaica with the wind behind us.
"I wouldn't risk being shot and hacked at and arrested and hanged if there were any choice about it," I said.
"Neither would I," he said dryly.
"But you..."
I began. Then stopped. I looked at him curiously.
"You really think that?" I said slowly. "That you don't have a choice about it? Don't you?"
He was turned slightly away from me, eyes fixed on the port. The sun shone on the bridge of his long, straight nose, and he rubbed a finger slowly up and down it. The broad shoulders rose slightly and fell.
"I'm a man, Sassenach," he said very softly, "if I thought there was a choice. Then I maybe couldn't do it. You didn't need to be so brave about things. If you can, you canna help it, aye?"
He looked at me then with a faint smile.
"Like a woman in childbirth, aye? You must do it, and it makes no difference if you're afraid. You'll do it. It's only when you can say no that it takes courage."
I lay quiet for a bit, watching him. He had closed his eyes and leaned back in the chair, auburn lashes long and absurdly childish against his cheeks. They contrasted strangely with the smudges beneath his eyes and the deeper lines at the corners.
He was tired. He'd barely slept since the sighting of the pirate vessel.
"I haven't told you about Graham Mingus, have I?" I said at last.
The blue eyes opened at once.
"No. Who was he?"
"A patient at the hospital in Boston."
Graham had been in his late 60s when I knew him. A Scottish immigrant who hadn't lost his burr, despite nearly 40 years in Boston. He was a fisherman, or had been. When I knew him, he owned several lobster boats and let others do the fishing for him. He was a lot like the Scottish soldiers I had known at Prestonpans and Falkirk, stoic and humorous at once, willing to joke about anything that was too painful to suffer in silence.
"You'll be careful now, lassie,"
was the last thing he said to me as I watched the anaesthetist set up the intravenous drip that would maintain him while I amputated his cancerous left leg.
Be sure you're taking off the right one now.
Don't worry, I assured him, patting the weathered hand that lay on the sheet. I'll get the right one.
You will?
His eyes widened in simulated horror.
I thought 'twas the left one was bad.
He was still chuckling asthmatically as the gas mask came down over his face. The amputation had gone well, and Graham had recovered and gone home. But I wasn't really surprised to see him back again 6 months later. The lab report on the original tumour had been dubious, and the doubts were now substantiated. Metastasis to the lymph nodes in the groin. I removed the cancerous nodes. Radiation treatment was applied. Cobalt. I removed the spleen to which the disease had spread, knowing that the surgery was entirely in vain, but not willing to give up.
It's a lot easier not to give up when it isn't you that's sick, I said, staring up at the timbers overhead.
Did he give up then? Jamie asked.
I don't think I'd call it that exactly.
I have been thinking, Graham announced.
The sound of his voice echoed tinnily through the earpieces of my stethoscope.
Have you? I said. Well, don't do it out loud till I've finished here. That's a good lad.
He gave a brief snort of laughter, but lay quietly as I auscultated his chest, moving the disc of the stethoscope swiftly from ribs to sternum.
All right, I said at last, slipping the tubes out of my ears and letting them fall over my shoulders. What have you been thinking about?
Killing myself.
His eyes met mine, straight on, with just a hint of challenge. I glanced behind me, to be sure that the nurse had left, then pulled up the blue plastic visitor's chair and sat down next to him. Pain getting bad? I asked. There are things we can do, you know. You only need to ask. I hesitated before adding the last. He never had asked. Even when it was obvious that he needed medication, he never mentioned his discomfort. To mention it myself seemed an invasion of his privacy. I saw the small tightening at the corners of his mouth.
I've a daughter, he said, and 2 grandsons, bonny lads. But I'm forgetting. You'll have seen them last week, aye?
I had. They came at least twice a week to see him, bringing scribbled school papers and autographed baseballs to show their grandpa.
And there's my mother living up to the rest home on Canterbury, he said thoughtfully. It costs dearly, that place, but it's clean, and the food's good enough she enjoys complaining about it while she eats.
He glanced dispassionately at the flat bedsheet and lifted his stump.
A month, do you think? 4? 3?
Maybe 3, I said.
With luck, I added idiotically.
He snorted at me and jerked his head at the IV drip above him.
Oh, and worse luck I wouldna wish on a beggar.
He looked around at all the paraphernalia, the automatic respirator, the blinking cardiac monitor, the litter of medical technology.
Nearly $100 a day it's costing to keep me here, he said. 3 months? That would be, great heavens, $10,000?
He shook his head, frowning.
A bad bargain, I call that. Not worth it.
His pale grey eyes twinkled suddenly up at me.
I'm Scots, you know, born thrifty. And not likely to get over it now.
So I did it for him, I said, still staring upward.
Or rather, we did it together.
He was prescribed morphia for the pain. That's like laudanum, only much stronger.
I drew off half of each ampule and replaced the missing bit with water. It meant he didn't get the relief of a full dose for nearly 24 hours. But that was the safest way to get a big dose with no risk of being found out. We talked about using one of the botanical medicines I was studying. I knew enough to make up something fatal, but I wasn't sure of it being painless, and he didn't want to risk me being accused if anyone got suspicious and did a forensic examination.
I saw Jamie's eyebrows lift and flapped a hand.
Doesn't matter. It's a way of finding out how someone died.
Ah, like a coroner's court.
A bit.
Anyway, he'd be supposed to have morphia in his blood. That wouldn't prove anything. So that's what we did.
I drew a deep breath.
There would have been no trouble if I'd given him the injection and left. That's what he'd asked me to do.
Jamie was quiet, eyes fixed intently on me. I couldn't do it, though. I looked at my left hand, seeing not my own smooth flesh, but the big swollen knuckles of a commercial fisherman and the fat green veins that crossed his wrist.
I got the needle in, I said.
I rubbed a finger over the spot on the wrist where a large vein crosses the distal head of the radius. But I couldn't press down the plunger. In memory, I saw Graham Mingus's other hand rise from his side, trailing tubes and close over my own. He hadn't much strength then, but enough. I sat there until he was gone, holding his hand. I felt it still, the steady beat of the wrist pulse under my thumb growing slower and slower still as I held his hand, and then waiting for a beat that didn't come. I looked up at Jamie, shaking off the memory. And then a nurse came in. It had been one of the younger nurses, an excitable girl with no discretion. She wasn't very experienced, but knew enough to tell a dead man when she saw one. And me, just sitting there, doing nothing, most undoctor-like conduct. And the empty morphia syringe lying on the table beside me. She talked, of course, I said. I expect she would. I had the presence of mind to drop the syringe into the incinerator chute after she left, though. It was her word against mine, and the whole matter was just dismissed. My mouth twisted wryly. Except that the next week they offered me a job as head of the whole department. Very important. A lovely office on the 6th floor of the hospital, safely away from the patients, where I couldn't murder anyone else. My finger was still rubbing absently across my wrist. Jamie reached out and stopped it by laying his own hand over mine.
"When was this, Sassenach?"
he asked, his voice very gentle.
"Just before I took Bree and went to Scotland. That's why I went, in fact. They gave me an extended leave, said I'd been working too hard, and deserved a nice vacation." I didn't try to keep the irony out of my voice. "I see."
His hand was warm on mine, despite the heat of my fever.
"If it hadn't have been for that, for losing your work, would you have come, Sassenach? Not just to Scotland, to me."
I looked up at him and squeezed his hand, taking a deep breath. "I don't know," I said. "I really don't. If I hadn't come to Scotland, met Roger Wakefield, found out that you..." I stopped and swallowed, overwhelmed. "It was Graham who sent me to Scotland," I said at last, feeling slightly choked. "He asked me to go someday and say hello to Aberdeen for him." I glanced up at Jamie suddenly. "I didn't. I never did go to Aberdeen."
"Dinna trouble yourself, Sassenach." Jamie squeezed my hand. "I'll take you there myself, when we go back. Not," he added practically, "that there's anything to see there."
It was growing stuffy in the cabin. He rose and went to open one of the stern windows.
"Jamie," I said, watching his back, "what do you want?"
He glanced around, frowning slightly in thought.
"Oh, an orange would be good," he said. "There's some in the desk, eh?"
Without waiting for a reply, he rolled back the lid of the desk, revealing a small bowl of oranges, bright among the litter of quills and papers.
"Do you want one too?"
"All right," I said, smiling.
"That wasn't really what I meant, though. I meant, what do you want to do, once we found Ian?" "Oh."
He sat down by the berth, an orange in his hands, and stared at it for a moment.
"Do you know," he said at last, "I dinna think anyone has ever asked me that, what it was I wanted to do."
He sounded mildly surprised.
Not as though you very often had a choice about it, is it? I said dryly. Now you do, though.
Aye, that's true.
He rolled the orange between his palms, head bent over the dimpled sphere.
I suppose it's come to you that we likely cannot go back to Scotland, at least for a time, he said.
I had told him of Tompkins' revelations about Sir Percival and his machinations, of course, but we had little time to discuss the matter or its implications.
It has, I said. That's why I asked.
I was quiet then, letting him come to terms with it. He had lived as an outlaw for a good many years, hiding first physically and then by means of secrecy and aliases, eluding the law by slipping from one identity to another. But now all these were known. There was no way for him to resume any of his former activities, or even to appear in public in Scotland. His final refuge had always been Lallybroch, but even that avenue of retreat was lost to him now. Lallybroch would always be his home, but it was no longer his. There was a new laird now. I knew he wouldn't begrudge the fact that Jenny's family possessed the estate, but he must, if he were human, regret the loss of his heritage. I could hear his faint snort, and thought he had probably reached the same point in his thinking that I had in mine.
"Not Jamaica or the English-owned islands either,"
he observed ruefully.
"Tom Leonard and the Royal Navy may think us both dead for the moment, but they'll be quick enough to notice otherwise if we stay for any length of time."
"Have you thought of America?"
I asked this delicately.
"The colonies, I mean."
He rubbed his nose doubtfully.
"Well, no. Hadn't really thought of it. It's true we'd likely be safe from the Crown there, but..."
He trailed off, frowning. He picked up his dirk and scored the orange quickly and neatly, then began to peel it.
"No one would be hunting you there," I pointed out. "Sir Percival hasn't got any interest in you unless you're in Scotland, where arresting you would do him some good. The British Navy can't very well follow you ashore, and the West Indian governors haven't anything to say about what goes on in the colonies either."
"That's true," he said. "But the colonies..."
He took a peeled orange in one hand and began to toss it lightly, a few inches in the air.
"It's very primitive, Sassenach," he said. "A wilderness, aye? I shouldn't like to take you into danger."
That made me laugh. And he glanced sharply at me, then, catching my thought, relaxed into a half-rueful smile.
"Aye, well, I suppose dragging you off to sea and letting you be kidnapped and locked up in a plague ship is dangerous enough. But at least I haven't let you be eaten by cannibals yet."
I wanted to laugh again, but there was a bitter note to his voice that made me bite my lip instead.
"There aren't any cannibals in America," I said.
"There are," he said heatedly. "I printed a book for a society of Catholic missionaries that told all about the heathen Iroquois in the north. They tie up their captives and chop bits off of them and then rip out their hearts and eat them before their eyes."
"They eat their hearts first and then the eyes, do they?" I said, laughing in spite of myself. "All right," I said, seeing his scowl. "I'm sorry. But for one thing, you can't believe everything you read, and for another..." I didn't get to finish. He leaned forward and grasped my good arm, tight enough to make me squeak with surprise.
"Damn you! Listen to me," he said. "It's no light matter."
"Well, no, I suppose not," I said tentatively. "I didn't mean to make fun of you, but Jamie, I did live in Boston for nearly 20 years. You've never set foot in America."
"That's true," he said evenly. "And you think the place you lived in is anything like what it's like now, Sassenach?"
"Well," I began, then paused.
While I had seen any number of historic buildings near Boston Common, sporting little brass plaques attesting to their antiquity, the majority of them had been built later than 1770, many a lot later. And beyond a few buildings...
"Well, no," I admitted. "It's not. I know it's not. But I don't think it's a complete wilderness. There are cities and towns now," I knew that much.
He let go of my arm and sat back. He still held the orange in his other hand.
I suppose that's so, he said slowly. You didn't hear so much of the towns, only that it's such a wild, savage place, though very beautiful. But I'm no a fool, Sassenach.
His voice sharpened slightly, and he dug his thumb savagely into the orange, splitting it in half.
I didn't believe something only because someone set words down in a book, for God's sake. I print the damn things. I ken very well just what charlatans and fools some writers are. I see them. And surely I ken the difference between a romance and a fact set down in cold blood.
All right, I said, though I'm not sure it's all that easy to tell the difference between romance and fact in print. But even if it's dead true about the Iroquois, the whole continent isn't swarming with bloodthirsty savages. I do know that much. It's a very big place, you know, I added gently.
Mm-hmm,
he said, plainly unconvinced. Still, he bent his attention to the orange and began to divide it into segments. This is very funny, I said ruefully. When I made up my mind to come back, I read everything I could find about England and Scotland and France about this time, so I'd know as much as I could about what to expect. And here we end up in a place I know nothing about, because it never dawned on me we'd cross the ocean with you being so seasick. That made him laugh, a little grudgingly.
Aye, well, you never ken what you can do till you have to. Believe me, Sassenach, once I've got Ian safely back, I shall never set foot on a filthy, godforsaken floating plank in my life again. Except to go home to Scotland when it's safe, he added, as an afterthought.
He offered me an orange segment, and I took it, token of a peace offering. Speaking of Scotland, you still have your printing press there, safe in Edinburgh, I said. We could have it sent over, maybe, if we settled in one of the larger American cities. He looked up at that, startled.
Do you think it would be possible to earn a living printing? There are that many people? It takes a fair-sized city, you ken, to need a printer or bookseller.
I'm sure you could. Boston, Philadelphia, not New York yet, I don't think. Williamsburg, maybe. I don't know which ones, but there are several places big enough to need printing. The shipping ports, certainly. I remembered the flapping posters advertising dates of embarkation and arrival, sales of goods and recruitment of seamen that decorated the walls of every seaside tavern in Le Havre.
Mm-hmm.
This one was a thoughtful noise.
Aye, well, if we might do that.
He poked a piece of fruit into his mouth and ate it slowly.
What about you?
He said abruptly. I glanced at him, startled. What about me? His eyes were fixed intently on me, reading my face.
Would it suit you to go to such a place?
He looked down then, carefully separating the other half of the fruit.
I mean, you've your work to do as well, aye?
He looked up and smiled wryly.
I learned in Paris that I couldn't stop you doing it. And you said yourself you might not have come had Mingus's death not stopped you where you were. Can ye be a healer in the colonies, do you think?
I expect I can, I said slowly. There are people sick and injured almost anywhere you go after all. I looked at him, curious. You're a very odd man, Jamie Fraser. He laughed at that and swallowed the rest of his orange.
Oh, I am, I. And what do you mean by that?
Frank loved me, I said slowly. But there were pieces of me that he didn't know what to do with. Things about me that he didn't understand or maybe that frightened him. I glanced at Jamie.
Not you.
His head was bent over a second orange, hands moving swiftly as he scored it with his dirk, but I could see the faint smile in the corner of his mouth.
No, Sassenach, you dinna frighten me. Or rather you do, but only when I think you may kill yourself from carelessness.
I snorted briefly.
"You scare me for the same reason, but I don't suppose there's anything I can do about it."
His chuckle was deep and easy.
"And you think I cannot do anything about it either, so I shouldn't be